Hi, this is Allison, the producer for On My Mind. A quick note about today's show. Diane's conversation with the New Yorker's Susan Glasser was recorded on the morning of Wednesday, June 1st. This was before a gunman shot and killed four people at a medical center in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Hi, it's Diane. On My Mind, will the mass school shooting in Uvalde finally push Washington to act on gun control? This is a question that's been asked before, reaching as far back as Columbine in 1999, then Newtown, then Parkland. But President Biden says this time must be different, and he's considering executive action to bypass the logjam in Congress. In a recent column, The New Yorker's Susan Glasser looked at political leadership in the aftermath of mass shootings dating back to 1966. She says the evolution of the country's reaction is a dramatic illustration of our growing dysfunction, that no amount of presidential leadership may be able to overcome. Susan, let me ask you how you would rate President Biden's reaction to the tragedy in Uvalde.
You know, Diane, it's such a tough question because, of course, President Biden, one of his skills, it seems to me, as a politician, is his ability to project empathy, his own personal experience as a parent who's lost a child. You know, he has perhaps more power and credibility on this subject than most in public life. And yet at the same time, it also is a tragic reminder of the gridlock and failure of American officials at all levels to respond to this obvious public health crisis and safety crisis in our country that's been going on for years. So, you know, in a way, right, it's hard to say, well, you handled something like this well, when the truth of the matter is probably people don't want hugs from Joe Biden. They want him and Democrats to do something about the problem.
And there's the question, what can the president, any president, do at this point with the Congress as deadlocked as it is?
Well, that's right, Diane. Unfortunately, the grim math of our politics is the grim math of our politics. You can't really change a 50-50 Senate. And it seemed that in the first year of the Biden presidency, there was a certain amount of willful suspension of, you know, belief, you know, around that fact. But obviously, subsequent events have shown that math is math. And, you know, we're here in Washington. There are talks occurring among a bipartisan group of senators. There's the usual, well, this time feels different. But it's competing against what I would call a sense of weary fatalism about our politics and a sense that we've been here before. And, you know, you and I both recall that horrible, painful moment when Barack Obama went into the White House press room after Sandy Hook and wept. And, you know, from a very genuine place of like, well, surely this must break our impasse. And we will do something now to protect children by moving to do something more on gun control. And of course, the exact opposite thing happened. And in the period since Sandy Hook, there are millions more guns on the streets of America. There are radical changes in gun laws across the country in states that are supportive of pro-gun laws, including in Texas, where the current governor has signed not just one, but many, many measures in recent years to make it easier for the person who carried out this attack to walk into a store on his 18th birthday and, you know, buy thousands of rounds of ammunition. I'm sure you had the same reaction when you saw, you know, Canada is responding to a massacre in Texas more quickly and more strongly and more decisively than America is.
What have they actually done?
Well, as I understand it, it's the Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, making a very bold proposal that would, go much farther than Canada already has much more restrictive gun laws than the United States, with which it shares this enormous border. And now saying he wants to take it even farther and ban most handguns. And even, as I understand it, require people to turn in some guns that they already have. And these are seen as completely inconceivable and impossible measures here in the United States.
And Australia did exactly the same thing.
Well, that's exactly right. There was a horrific shooting, and this is now decades ago, actually, and it caused the country to transform its gun laws literally within weeks. Same thing, of course, in Britain. There was a terrible shooting a couple decades ago, again, a massive, rapid, swift social and political response.
So the question becomes, you mentioned this joint group of congressional members talking about what they might be able to do. Are they going to go beyond stronger medical checks? Or are they going to go beyond more red flag checks? Even that may stall. Are they going to go beyond ghost guns? What can that group come up with that can actually get 60 votes in the Senate?
Well, Diane, that's where the fatalism sets in, because first of all, you're exactly right. Even the measures that they're discussing, and I don't think this gets put in front of people enough. We get so hung up on congressional process and, oh, there's talks. Well, even in a best case scenario, as far as I can tell, these talks are going to produce measures that would not have prevented this tragedy. And what they're talking about doing with red flag laws and, additional checks and, mental health background checks, let's be honest, we're talking about often, as in this case in Texas right now, kids who had not previously tripped the wires of the system. So unless you're going to ban the sale of assault rifles to people who can't even vote and drink alcohol, then, it would have had no effect on, the scenario that we saw play out last week in Texas. So that's even in a best case scenario that they do something, which is not at all a foregone conclusion at this point. So I think your question is exactly right. And I'm surprised that, there's a little bit of credulousness that always kicks in, in the coverage of these talks when people say, oh, well, they're talking, they're negotiating, they're going to do this. What is it that even a positive outcome would mean? It's far less than the kind of gun control measures that used to be talked about and are currently seen as politically impossible. Remember that there was an assault weapons ban that was passed in this country in 1993, and until it expired, guess what? The number of school shootings and other mass shootings was lower. And when the ban expired, that's when you see the numbers go up. This isn't brain surgery, people.
This column of yours, looking back at mass shootings over the decades, you start with Texas, University of Texas at Austin in 1966. Tell us what happened then and what the reaction was to that very first one.
Well, Diane, I was thinking the other day, how do you write about sort of the politics of these horrible recurring theme in American life, unfortunately, these mass shootings. And it says something about the United States, not something very good, that, there's a niche for everything. And, presidential historian Tevi Troy had actually written a very interesting survey and look at presidents and how they have responded to mass shootings over the years since. He dates the beginning of the modern era of mass shootings to 1966. And, again, in no other country would this even be a whole category, right? This is like an expected part of the presidency and presidents having a playbook. But LBJ, it did not have a playbook. And of course, this was on his home territory in Austin, Texas, basically a shooter in the University of Texas Tower, and was just a sniper basically taking aim. Very large number of both deaths and casualties that were recorded, and that horrified the nation. LBJ used that crisis as he used the crises of the shooting of President Kennedy and the shooting of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy later to force and work with Congress to take action. And there was actual gun control measures that resulted from pretty directly from that 1966 shooting. Now, then you go on, interestingly, different presidents, according to their political philosophies, had different approaches in the early years. Ronald Reagan, a determined sort of federalist and not wanting to nationalize these events. There were a number of horrific shootings that captured the nation's attention back in the 1980s. When I was a kid in high school, you remember that term going postal. Well, that actually was because of an incident that took place in a post office by a disgruntled employee. I didn't realize this, but he actually never commented on that or on other things. So he, unlike presidents today who make a point of addressing the nation, things like that, it was actually Bill Clinton was the first president to devote a presidential radio address, one of his weekly radio addresses, to the issue of mass shootings. And that was actually even before Columbine, which was probably the defining beginning of the modern era of shootings. And now they happen so frequently that basically presidents tend to have a template and a playbook for how to respond to them. But again, what it really mostly tells you is that this is a country that, you know, has essentially baked a certain amount of this mayhem and violence into our political culture right now.
Tell us more about President Clinton.
Well, President Clinton, you know, again, he, I think, set the template and the expectation, right, that a president would be a kind of a national mourner-in-chief. We also remember that, say, from the Oklahoma City bombing, and as well as from Columbine and other things like that. You saw that also with President Obama, not only in the wake of Sandy Hook, but also probably one of the most memorable moments of his presidency was after an attack inside an African-American church in South Carolina. He not only went to the funeral service there, but sang extemporaneously Amazing Grace and really probably defined, you know, for a generation what it meant to be a president channeling national grief and mourning. At the same time, what I see with President Biden is much more weariness, even in the Obama era, right? I think there was a hope and an expectation that perhaps something constructive and concrete could come out of these tragedies. I don't feel that expectation now. Certainly, you know, people who are looking for action, you know, haven't given up entirely on the idea that it might occur. But it's a much more jaded, weary moment in our politics. And what I worry is that you can't even be a national mourner in chief anymore, that there are such alternate realities in this country that nobody even wants a president to play the same role that a president used to play.
Going back as you did to 1966, has the NRA become more powerful each year, even unto now?
You know, Diane, I'm not at all an expert on this. There are a lot of journalists who devoted enormous investigative effort to understanding it. And one point that I've seen them make that I think is important is that, yes, in the sense, in the broadest sense, right, that the NRA has been one of the most successful political lobbies of the modern political era in the United States and has succeeded largely by pursuing a federalist approach and pursuing state legislatures and governors as opposed to focus on Congress, has managed to institutionalize pro-gun laws in so many of these states. Now, of course, it's also a result of the Supreme Court's ruling, in the Heller case, that we have this modern era, essentially, of enabling pro-gun laws to a much more extreme degree than in the past. But remember also that the NRA has really struggled in recent years as an actual organization. It's gone bankrupt. There have been huge scandals involving its former president, Wayne LaPierre.
But nevertheless.
And nevertheless. And so that's the thing that I think is important. It is actually Republican voters and, you know, state legislatures and Republican elected officials in many states around the country that are the real reason for this. So I think that's important. It's not just, you know, some organization that's imposing an agenda that isn't supported. It is supported by millions of Americans. You know, there was, you know, there was a kid I noticed at the Trump rally in Wyoming the other day. Trump is going all out there, obviously, to campaign against Liz Cheney, his big foe since January 6th. And the kid, you know, little kid wearing a T-shirt, God, guns, and Trump. And in a way, that's the theology of the modern Republican Party.
And even though the majority of Americans want to see something done on gun control.
That's right, Diane. I think that the numbers are very striking and have been for such a long time. Even majority of members of the NRA, by the way, or Republicans self-identified in surveys, support a large number of gun control measures. And so that's where you see how the fact that our politicians are drawn from the extremes of each party. And that's, I think, a classic example of how they're pulling even their own electorates farther and farther away from any kind of centrist governing agenda.
Now a quick break. Here is the rest of my conversation with Susan Glasser, staff writer at The New Yorker. So it seems as though more and more of these shootings are occurring now. It seems as though the pace even is picking up. I mean, just 3 weeks before what happened in Uvalde, you had another mass shooting in a grocery store.
Well, that's right. And explicitly targeting that in a way that appeared to be a very explicitly racial attack. And the numbers are clear cut on this, Diane. You're right. It's not just a feeling. The numbers of these shootings are going up. And that seems to, if anything, have exacerbated the sense of political fatalism and the inability to do anything about it, which is a unique and striking aspect of American political culture. When you think of our long historical tradition of progressive reform, it seems so at odds with our throwing up our hands collectively and saying, well, too bad we can't do anything about this, even though every other country in the world has done something about this.
Now, this may sound like wishful thinking, but could the acceleration of these mass shootings propel more Democrats and Republicans who believe that more gun control should take place? Is there any chance in your thought that it might be reflected in these midterm elections?
You know, big sigh, Diane, because I think we have to be, you know, clear-eyed in understanding the challenges in front of us. I do think that there's a motivating factor that can cut both ways. Certainly, it may help to reinforce the Democratic message that it already has, largely to its own base voters, which is that Republicans are extremists, promoting an extreme agenda. And this, I think, would reinforce that feeling. Obviously, there's also the forthcoming abortion decision and the prospect of repealing Roe versus Wade. I think it's very consistent with that message that Democrats will have to their voters. The flip side is the more real that the prospect of gun control becomes, Diane, the more that it may become an additional motivating factor for Republicans to turn out. Right now, it's not high on the list of either Democrats or Republicans. If you look in polls, when people have asked before these current wave of shootings, well, how much does guns or gun regulation figure in your issues that you care about in the midterm elections? Before this round of shootings, they weren't showing up. But if Republican voters who care a lot about making it easy to access guns think that there's the possibility of more gun restrictions, then you could see that actually cutting the opposite direction. And the reason I say this is because it's not theoretical, because that's literally what happened before in the wake of Sandy Hook.
Susan, what could this mean for the Senate itself? More and more people are losing faith in our governing process. What could this mean for the Senate itself?
Well, I think you're right to see this as part of the broader crisis of legitimacy of our institutions. And one thing that's interesting is that, you know, the former President Trump obviously made delegitimizing institutions and attacks on our political culture a core part of his political appeal and identity. And, you know, you may now see that while those numbers went off the charts for Republicans as a result of their leader attacking, rival institutions, Democrats may now also begin and are losing faith in institutions as well when they see that even winning control of the White House and the House of Representatives and very tenuously the Senate has not yielded what they want. You see, for example, in younger voters who have turned away from Joe Biden in droves, according to the polls, they're like, well, where's my, forgiveness for my loans, for my student loans? And, you know, don't have a deep understanding of the political gridlock that has made that hard for Democrats to deliver. And so I think that you face this risk across the political spectrum of people looking at an institution like the Senate and saying it doesn't work.
But how close are we to people seeing that government does not work anymore?
Well, I think we've already, been in the danger zone for a long time, certainly at the federal level on that, Diane. And I think the numbers and surveys bear that out. Now, mitigating against that has been, of course, a relative sense of greater competence and accountability at the state and local level, right? And you've seen, in recent years, a lot more pragmatic, bipartisan governments coming out of states and localities, right? And, I always found when I was editor of Politico, it was a refreshing thing to get out of Washington and to talk to politicians who actually were accountable on a day in and day out basis to people. I used to love to talk, to mayors around the country who were actually getting things done.
Yes.
And I think that has, for many Americans, mitigated against a total disillusionment with government. But things like Texas, you see the complete failure and breakdown of local officials, local governance, local police departments, state legislature, state governor, right? All of those terrible factors were in play in this awful school shooting, right? And so, of course, that contributes to Americans' sense of disillusionment in their own institutions of democracy.
So does Biden get the blame for another effort that proves absolutely fruitless?
Diane, I think that there's a certain sense, of course, among his supporters, among Democrats, of a weary acceptance that, of course, it's not his fault. This problem predated him. It will probably post-date him. But there is a bigger crisis of presidential leadership that you see surrounding Biden right now and is a factor in why his approval ratings have been so low. Remember that Republicans already were not supporting Biden, obviously, as president. And so the fall in his approval ratings has come largely from independents, and Democrats who were willing to support him and did many of them support him in the election. And I think it goes to this question of what does it mean to be a president and to be a leader right now in such a sclerotic and broken system? And so in that sense, I do think that there could be a negative effect on Biden, just in that, okay, well, you know, he's not able to break through and get us out of this mess.
If Republicans are successful in the midterms, as predicted, do you believe that they're going to relax gun controls even further?
I wouldn't rule it out, Diane. Absolutely not, especially with the very, very potentially transformative 6-3 majority that they now have on the Supreme Court. This is not a conservative majority, I would say, on the Supreme Court. It's a revisionist majority on the Supreme Court, willing to, I think, jettison even what we would consider to be many settled laws. And so given that reality and the possibility of a Republican takeover of the House, very likely, and the Senate, quite possible as well, absolutely, I would think that's a risk.
Susan, in all the times I've spoken with you, you've never seemed quite as down as you seem now.
Well, Diane, I think because, you know, it was conceivable in some ways, even up to January 6th or the days immediately following it, to conceive of a world where what we saw in recent years was an outlier, a mistake, that it could be corrected in some ways. But I think we can pretty definitively say at this point that the trajectory is clear. We have to look at it. We have to understand that the country has hurtled to a new level of polarization and division and an extreme form of partisanship that suggests that our fissures, which already existed, of course, and our fault lines are hardening and even widening in a way that it's not clear at all what beyond some crisis of even greater magnitude will bring about a resolution.
Susan Glatzer, thank you for joining us.
Diane, great to be with you today. Thank you so much.
That was Susan Glatzer, staff writer at The New Yorker. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Lansferk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Adrian Danhauser. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.